Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I am your host, Nicholas Larimer, and I'm joined today by Ms. Sarah Gon. Sarah, how are you doing on this sweltering spring day?
I'm sweltering.
Yes, as am I, in my fortress of solitude. And of course, we also have Mr. Herman Pretorius, who is, I'm not actually sure where he is, but I think it might be Pretoria. And I imagine it's even hotter there. Herman, how are you?
Yes. No, I'm fine, thanks. I do sort of feel a bit Dick Cheney in the sense that I'm in an undisclosed location. And my favorite bit about the Dick Cheney undisclosed locations is that every now and again, you could just see the gray curtain behind him flapping a bit, and you realize he's in his office. So I must say, I'm in an undisclosed location in somewhere in Pretoria North.
Very good. All right, so let us dive into the news of today. And the first story is, it's a compliment to the one we did yesterday. So yesterday we talked, of course, about the EFF and the DA manifestos. So you can check that out in our episode yesterday. But yesterday we saw the launch of the ANC's manifesto. And, of course, that's the big one because despite all the setbacks that they're expected to suffer in this election, they will still be the largest party by far, governing the majority of municipalities. So it's worth looking at what exactly they are offering to voters in this local government election. The launch was, I think, Sarah said, at prime time last night, and President Cyril Ramaphosa said, quote, "One of the biggest pledges the ANC makes to you is that we are doing things better and differently to make sure the best people run municipalities." Well, are they doing things differently? Because I just looked through the manifesto, pulled out a couple of things that just sort of stuck out to me. And I must say, the impression I got, and I'm not sure if everyone else will get the same impression, was that there's really very little new. In fact, an awful lot of the manifesto seem to be, what are we currently doing? Let's just put that in. So we have a whole bunch of vague stuff like, establish the 44 district councils and 8 metros as central points for economic development, job creation, investment, and reduction of poverty and inequality. As opposed to what? Bring integrated government closer to the people. Encourage and build capacity for gender-sensitive and responsive budgeting, and prioritize disability as a cross-cutting issue. School feeding schemes will go ahead as they should, according to the ANC, which is a bit strange because they cut them during the pandemic. Then there's this gem, ensure ANC-led municipalities are run by ethical leaders, managers, and workers. Sarah, let me start with you. I'll bring up some more as we're going on. But it really does seem to me as though the party does not have that many new ideas. And it does have a couple which stuck out to you. What were those?
Well, the two things stuck out that actually weren't in the manifesto per se. I was just driving home and there was a poster, one of the news posters, saying, please give us another chance, says ANC. And the answer was, not on your life. But anyway, the problem with what they're saying is it's a sign of a party who still doesn't know where it's going. Because, in fact, the shorter and more specific the manifesto, the more likely it is, I would say, certainly my response would be, to take it more seriously, because while your municipal rights are fundamental rights, they're not about smart cities, they're not about feeding schemes, because feeding schemes are provincial, they relate to education, which is a provincial competency. So as soon as you start to talk about being aware of people's gender rights, and you can't be taken seriously, because with all due respect, that is not what worries people. I mean, I saw gender equality in action when both two women and two men somewhere in the Limpopo complained about the potholes. You know, so it shows a combination of insecurity and a complete lack of ideas, because you don't need smart ideas. You need to say 5 things, and one of them is we'll provide water, and another one is we'll make sure that the electricity works, and the third one is we'll keep your rates at the, you know, that sort of thing. And the government's throwing in all this stuff that isn't, actually is completely meaningless and irrelevant to what is a very specific election about hands-on, on-the-ground, the provision of services.
So, Herman, I want to go through a couple more of the things here. Apparently, the ANC is promising to overhaul government procurement to make it transparent, free of corruption, and use it to more effectively promote the development of Black and woman-owned businesses and cooperatives, deal urgently with unacceptable levels of drug and alcohol abuse in many communities, revitalize cooperatives, revitalize infrastructure and industrial parks to attract investment and create employment in communities, reduce red tape, especially for small, micro, and medium enterprises and informal businesses, speed up approvals and reduce licensing costs, develop the nighttime economy, leisure, and sporting activities. This will include initiatives to encourage retailers to stay open later, more Wi-Fi hotspots linked to better security and good lighting. And there was also a whole bunch of stuff in there which seemed almost in reference to the Tswane cabbage patch argument about how they would improve food security by making it easier for people to plant vegetables on the sidewalk. So, Herman, what do you make of some of those ones? I mean, the reducing red tape seems like a good one.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's some good stuff in there. I've got a few ideas for them. If you want to, you know, decrease the alcohol consumption, just get Batabile Dlamini out of there. And if you want to plant vegetables on the sidewalk, just give Jesse Duarte a chair to sit on. But beyond that, the real tragedy of these, yes, I might just have committed hate speech. I don't know, but I enjoyed it. It was worth it. There are some good ideas here, but the fundamental problem is that you run into the reality that it's not the government's place to convince traders to stay open later. I mean, where on God's good earth is it that does the government need to tell businesses, stay open a bit longer, then you'll make more money? I mean, just leave it up to these business people to decide for themselves. One of the things that really caught me off guard in a way when I moved to Cape Town a few years ago was the vibrant nightlife economy. But I can promise you the state had very, very little to do with it. It's just that these businesses understood that if they add 2-3 hours to their opening hours, they get clients, and it really is just the basic stuff. But as Sarah points out, the real nonsense comes in when you try to make ideological or deeply ideological arguments with municipal elections. The closest ideological contention one might reach in municipal elections is how heavily should the government be involved in managing the economic activities in that area, and also should there be cater deployment? That's essentially the two ideological questions. For the rest, it is just make the trains run on time, pay the bills when they need to be paid, have a contract ready and approved when the contract needs to be ready and approved. The moment you start going into ideological promises, it's because you don't have a track record. And that's exactly what's happening here. And I must say, that's why I'm quietly optimistic about the DA's election pitch, is just, do you want service delivery? Because that's all that local elections are actually, at the end of the day, about. And the fact is that you've got two big parties. Yeah, the IFP and some independent and smaller parties have been in charge of municipalities. But the reality is local elections is the tamest beast of elections, because it really is just a matter of, do you sign the checks on time? Do you pay the bills on time? Are you responsive to complaints? There's very little ideology in it. And the fact that the ANC has to try and conjure some sort of ideological movement here just shows that they know, if they were to stand on their record of paying things on time, having water in taps, I mean, it would be a greater comedic show than it currently is. And it must have been very, very awkward for President Ramaphosa to be so near the statue of President Kruger, because I think that statue has done more in its political career than Cyril Ramaphosa has. So you've got these two presidents of spectacular inaction, but the one at least does it while being bronze, and the other one just while being, you know, useless.
So what really struck me about it was just the sort of lack of credibility. And, you know, any party that's been in power for a really long time, I think, does run into this problem of kind of trying to make things look a little bit fresh So, of course, the ANC's manifesto, as I said here, that aims to reduce red tape, especially for informal businesses and small businesses. And I sort of think to myself, well, they've had, you know, many, many years of many of these metros to do that, and it just doesn't happen. If anything, we've seen things go in the other direction. There's just no credibility whatsoever behind some of the good ideas here. And I think that really is the problem they're suffering from. If your election pitch is, oh, please, guys, please give us another chance, you're not in a very good position going to the election.
And the thing is also, let's be realistic. On a municipal level, it's not red tape making business difficult. It is the fact that you don't have good roads to get your goods to or from market. It's that you don't have a reliable water or power supply. Just do those three things, those three basic things, and, you know, improve metropolitan police services, and the businesses will thank you for it. There's no, the red tape is on a national policy level. We've got nonsense like the minimum wage and, you know, labor regulations per sector, and you know, nonsense like the mining charter where the government tries to micromanage. But that's at a different level. If on a local level you want to stimulate business, do four things. Have roads that people can drive on. Have electricity that people can use, have water that'll be there when you open a tap, and improve security. That's it. It's not about red tape at this level of government. It's about basic competence.
Can I just say that your point about, just another point about red tape, is the informal sector is dissuaded from becoming the formal sector because of the red tape they would be exposed to if they became formal. I mean, there are bylaws that do affect the informal sector, but if you want to increase the larger tax base, you've got to make at the national level and at every level the red tape for formal business simpler and less onerous. But I think one of the problems is you've got a sort of, what, a 25, 28 page manifesto. The four issues that Herman raises could be put in a paragraph.
Right. So one of the things that also struck me was that the manifesto does, of course, mention the fact that there needs to be improvement in financial sustainability in municipalities, because, of course, an enormous number of municipalities around the country are basically either bankrupt or on the verge of bankruptcy. Even some of the bigger ones are in a bit of a rough financial state. But there's no real suggestion of how this is going to be done. And I think that, you know, say what you will about the EFF manifesto, which I think has many bad ideas in it, and some of them may be illegal, but at least there's like some ideas there. The DA manifesto, of course, also has some ideas as well. But the ANC one is just seems a bit contentless. Any final thoughts, Sarah?
I'm not giving them another chance.
Well, on that note, let us move on to the next topic, and that is Justice Minister Ronald Lamola has slammed Deputy Chief Justice Raymond Zondo's application for another extension of the state's state capture inquiry. So, of course, the state capture inquiry commission thing has been going on under Zondo's oversight for the past, what is it now, 2-3 years since 2018, I think. It was originally meant to take 6 months, and this would be its fifth extension. Ronald Lamola, the Justice Minister, said that while Zondo had asked for 3 months of additional time, he said that they only were going to give them budget for 6 months, 6 weeks, sorry, because they said that it's simply costing the department too much money. He said he was not opposing Zondo's application for an extension, but said that it was excessive and possibly unconstitutional to keep dragging this thing out for too much longer. And I must say, one could read this cynically and say, the ANC is just trying to get rid of the Zondo Commission. But it has taken a very long time, and it is costing at least the Department of Justice quite a lot of money. Sarah, I think our colleague Gabriel Krauser made a comparison to another commission, I think on SARS, which finished its work in a much shorter time and had very concrete, actionable steps, whereas the Zondo Commission just sort of seems to go on and on and on in the background, and not much comes of it. I mean, there's shocking revelations, but not much beyond that.
Well, part of the problem is, it's actually the same thought struck me, is that, you know, one of the things is you have to control something like that sort of commission very, very tightly. And I just don't think it's not in Judge Zondo's nature to be as tight as Judge Nugent was on the SARS commission, you know, really keeping a tight rein. I don't know how they dealt with keeping a record of, you know, dealing with the evidence in terms of writing up a finding as they went along, or whether it's been left to the end. I'm not quite sure how it's been done, but it strikes me as it should have been a work in progress all the way, because there's so much information coming before it. Whether it needed to canvass quite as much as it did, or the depth is another question altogether. But it needed to be, I think he needed to get tougher more often. I don't say it would have shortened it enough, but, you know, what are you going to now do with 3 years of, I think it's a kind of like, okay, perhaps the best thing we got from the Zondo Commission is that it was public and we heard the stuff and we saw the stuff and we saw the no goodness that went on, and we know. And maybe that's as much catharsis as we can expect, because unless the commission concertinas into half the amount of time necessary to put out a final report, I think for them it's going to be an absolute nightmare. And as I say, I'm just not sure that they didn't have to be much more streamlined with their terms of reference.
So, Herman, what do you make of the length of the Zondo Commission? Some would argue, and I see some people sort of saying that in the comments, that it should take as long as it needs to take. And others are sort of saying, well, you know, is this really enough already? Like, surely we've got the point now. What do you make of all this?
Well, my personal conviction is that God created commissions of inquiry to give mortals an idea of what eternity would feel like. The problem is that in instigating a commission of inquiry to look into state capture and corruption in South Africa with an ANC government is like funding research to investigate the connection between music and sound. It is so broad and so all-encompassing and so obvious, obviously exhaustive, that you'll have to look at every breath Jacob Zuma took while president, that it becomes an absurdity. It really becomes absurd. And there's this, I mean, the good old quote, once you learn to fake sincerity, you've got it made. That's all that a commission of inquiry really is. It's a government faking sincerity. And someone should tell President Ramaphosa that, you know, he has more powers than instituting these commissions. But a commission of inquiry really is, I mean, it's masturbatory governance. You have the example of the Seriti Commission. Now, just for some context, the Seriti Commission thing is still going on in as you know, political football. The arms deal was in 1999. Then in 2000, about 10 years later, in 2011 or so, you've got the Seriti Commission. It delivers its report in 2016. Then in 2019, we're already approaching, in 2019, 20 years after the allegations or after the alleged wrongdoing, the court, the South African judiciary, throws out the report of the commission. Now it's in front of the JSE in the year 2021. It's almost, you know, we have no closure on it. The Seriti Commission sat. It sat for years. It delivered its report, and nothing came of it because no one took it seriously. The problem with the Zondo Commission is, who will take it seriously? It's at the same time too broad and at this and not exhaustive enough, because it is, you know, investigating whether wet paint is wet. It really is just a media circus, frankly, to pretend like someone's doing something about it. In any sensible country, after 2 days of the Zondo Commission, you would have had the National Prosecuting Authority on that, like, you know, Velcro on another piece of Velcro, where it's just immediately looking, oh, we've got prima facie evidence here of wrongdoing, we must investigate. But now the Zondo Commission has just become the go-to refrain for whenever someone asks the ANC, what are you doing about corruption? Oh, well, Zondo is still busy. But the problem is, Zondo will be busy for a length of time, and then afterwards he will publish his stuff, and those things will be ping-ponged through the courts, then ping-ponged through the Judicial Services Commission. The problem is, it achieves nothing. It is the wanking equivalence of accountability.
Well, that's quite the visual image you created there, Haman. Sarah, any final thoughts?
Yeah. No, I mean, you see, the problem is if you think of how many hundreds of millions this has cost, you're still in a situation where you've got an NPA that hasn't got the resources to follow up on the prosecutions that could be done that have come to light as a result of the commission. And that's why I said, I see one of our audience members disagrees, but to a large extent, we're just never going to get to that level of prosecutions. I think we're going to have to be satisfied with relatively few, and the best is we kind of know a lot of what happened. I think the other problem is that I think we underestimate just the extent to which corruption and everything related, state capture, is so embedded in our body politic that it's an infinite job. So in any event, we will never be satisfied, because at the best that the prosecuting authorities can do is pick cases that they can prove. My advice, for what it's worth, would be don't try and prove 20 things against somebody. 2, 1, 3 will do.
They got Capone on tax fraud. And also... It's now R1 billion. The Zondo Commission it will cost. Imagine we just gave R1 billion to the National Prosecuting Authority. It would have been of more use, because nothing new was laid bare really at the Zondo Commission that hasn't been unearthed through investigative journalism over the last few years. So it is really R1 billion awfully spent. Just honestly, if you're looking for accountability and you've got R1 billion to play with, my goodness, use it to fund the NPA or something, or at least create a brand new NPA, or give it to Harry now for pizza.
Right, let's move abroad now for our final story of today. And it looks like that South Africa is setting the trends for the world. We, of course, had load shedding, and now it looks like a lot of the world has decided to get in on the energy crisis business. Over the past couple of days, we've seen shortages of fuel in the UK. Problems there. But the latest development in the sort of global problems with energy is that the People's Republic of China is suffering from power outages. Now, there's a lot of reasons behind this. There were power outages yesterday, which affected a lot of manufacturing areas. They've effectively had what we would call load shedding, with power utilities having to ration power as they weren't able to produce enough. This has especially hurt factories like those that produce goods for Apple and Tesla. And 10 different Chinese provinces have been forced to ration power. Now, one of the reasons for this is because the Chinese state imposed emission targets on their provinces, saying that you cannot produce a certain amount of carbon emissions per year. And in order to hit some of those targets, some of the provinces simply shut down their power stations for a time. but perhaps the bigger problem is that there are shortages of coal. And this is in no small part due to China's, I guess you could call it, trade war with Australia. So as Australia began to take a more, shall we say, robust stance towards China, the Chinese halted the import of all Australian coal. Well, while a lot of news coverage focused on the effect this was having on the Australian economy, it looks like China was not immune from the damage either. And they have certainly been hurt by it, as something like, I think it's literally hundreds of millions of people are now being affected by power outages across China. And of course, China is a major manufacturing country, so it's certainly going to hurt global supply chains a bit. Herman, what do you make of all of this?
Well, I think it's sort of the Fukuyama chickens coming home to roost in a very bizarre way, because the Chinese energy crisis is also now affecting the UK. And I think the end of historyism that took hold in the, you know, in the 90s, early 2000s, was that, you know, we've neutralized the command control economies, bad actors of Russia and China. But the problem is, if you now go look at the situation, that naivety of, let's call them liberals, victorious liberals after, liberals after the Cold War, has led to a situation where if China sneezes, a gas plant blows up in France. It's no longer just this idea of, China is a difficult thing to manage and Russia is a difficult thing to manage. I think the naivety of some globalists in the Fukuyama's delirium of, you know, winning the Cold War has caused China to get all the benefits from becoming part of the world market, becoming the dominant economy that it is, without actually committing to the, you know, let's call it world order, of not being a bastard. So where in the past you might have had this sort of relationship of power provision between France and the UK or Germany and the UK or whatever, you now have the naivety of such a relationship being established, yet you don't have that liberal democratic framework on which you can rely, in which some things are just not done. So the real problem here is that you have the weakness of the West, the Fukuyamaism of the end of history kicking in over the last 30 years, the West decadently sleepwalking into, you know, irrelevance, and you've got a resurgent China, a resurgent Russia starting to flex their muscles because the UK is experiencing this problem because of its dependence on European electricity, and Europe is dependent on Russia's gas pipeline. So by naively assuming the broad framework of classical liberalism or liberal democracy and then just trading as if Boris Yeltsin will govern Russia in perpetuity and not accepting that, you know, some Russian mad nationalist theocratic, you know, strongman might come along and re-energize that national identity, was a massive gamble that is now starting to look quite stupid. And that's where I think the West has at last rediscovered some chutzpah in the Australian, American, and UK submarine trade, military alliance. That's the first time that the special relationship of the US-UK has now extended to the Indo-Pacific as a bit of a check on China. And the last thing that I would say is be very careful of China over the next decade. It is starting to slow in terms of its economic growth. It's reaching that point that Imperial Japan reached just before the Second World War, where dominance and growth economically and militarily is starting to ease off, to plateau a bit. And that always makes your strongman politicians, if you have one in charge, a bit nervous. And if we know about, you know, Winnie the Flu, he is an absolutely, you know, just a resuscitation of the worst of Maoist Chinese strongman politics.
So yeah, I really love shows like this because they make it easier to plan my holidays. Now I know that I don't have to ever go to China because I'll be arrested. Sarah, your thoughts on the energy crisis?
I think what the energy crisis is doing is showing up in particularly, let me say, in the UK and Europe, but it has ramifications in a different way in America, because in America you've got the New Green Deal, which seeks to eliminate, you know, fossil fuel energy, etc. And you've got Boris Johnson in the UK sort of, he wants to be the hero of COP26 later this year. The problem is that, you know, if it doesn't make sense. I mean, everyone understands that renewables have limited application because they are not always reliable. So they have to be buffeted by other types of energy provision. Most of the world is still developing, so they can't wait to be completely energy efficient in renewables to develop. But I think the first world, you know, the activists tend to forget this. And people like Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez with her New Green Deal, you know, she wants these New Deal jobs, and new jobs will come on stream. Apparently about 1 million people will lose their jobs in the post-oil era, and not all of them will be able to take up jobs in the new era. Anyway, said jobs would be lower earning. So none of these practicalities seem to strike. Everyone seems to go on this, oh, we must get to zero carbon emission, we must get to wind and stuff. Guys, if you don't want to be dependent on anyone else and you want reliable energy, nuclear. Stop shutting down your plants.
Yeah, that's the kind of elephant in the room here, is that everyone's talking about getting to carbon zero, and then they talk about sticking up windmills in the sea rather than building nuclear power plants, which kind of shows that people are not serious, or at least haven't really thought through this stuff. You know, maybe renewables will be able to do this kind of stuff in 30 years, although that's kind of what they said 30 years ago. But we're not there yet. And nuclear power is good stuff. Well, when you do it properly, which is the key. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. So thank you very much for listening to the show. We hope that you enjoyed it. Please like, comment, subscribe, leave us good reviews, all that stuff. And we shall see you tomorrow on the Daily Friends Show. Cheers, everyone.